Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Kyrsten Sinema spent several million dollars, even before the primary election started going, positive messages. Martha McSally didn't have that option. She didn't have that opportunity. She had to fight two well-known primary opponents.
I have to follow the law. I'm responsible for my campaign, and I think my campaign was a positive campaign that not only talked about my record, but what I'd like to do in the future, and it also contrasts my plan and my opponent's plan. The RGA did the same.
Judges are allowed to make political contributions, and often do. Judges obviously are allowed to privately express their views on candidates for office. This is one big step removed from that because Bill is not a candidate for public office.
Someone like Congressman Pastor, because of his nature, he's just so unassuming, so sincere, that I think for a lot of our students who've never met any kind of elected official before, he was really inspiring. He was someone that a lot of students could see, oh, this guy's just like my uncle or my grandpa, you know, so if they could imagine growing up to be like him.
And with us to talk about the late Congressman Ed Pastor, the McSally campaign's analysis of its Senate loss, and more, our former legislative leader Art Hamilton and political consultant Chris Baker of Trailhead Strategic Communications. Guys, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's start with Ed Pastor. Served Arizona in the Congress for about two decades, a little bit more than that. And a lot of nice things, of course, are being said about him. How much of this came down to the fact that he was a pragmatic person who, frankly, brought home things to Arizona when a lot of other members of the delegation were kind of opposed to that?
I think it was his ultimate strength. Number one, he understood the notion of being bipartisan. Secondly, he understood his obligation to try to make sure that as the pie was being divided, that Arizonans didn't have to go to Connecticut or in Montana to see their federal money. As long as there was a way to bring money home, Ed did that. And Phoenix Children's Hospital, the airport, Tucson, all this entire state benefited by his obligation to see that Arizona received its fair share.
Chris, how did that work, though? Because he obviously voted as a progressive, no question. So did you feel like as a conservative he was able to straddle that line then?
He was able to straddle the line. And I think the primary reason he was able to do that is he was respected by the Republican members of the delegation. You know, the ability to work across partisan lines, he was fantastic at that. And when you're able to do that, whether you're in the minority or the majority, which he served both during his career, it works out well. And he was able to really do well for his constituents and the state.
Art, I want to come back to something that you said about Congressman Pastor's ability to bring money back to Arizona. And some of the things you mentioned were not in his district. How did people who maybe weren't in his congressional district see him as somebody who also could maybe help them out for their projects?
Well, he was simply always willing to listen. I think Ronnie Lopez said what I think is most telling about Congressman Pastor is that if he could help you, he would help you. And frankly, he paid great attention to his district, great attention to the folks that actually elected him, but he understood he was a congressman from Arizona. And if, in fact, he could be helpful and had the juice to do that and had the ability to add something else to his plate that he wanted, he would do that.
Chris, did you get the sense that he had sort of a senior role, sort of a bridge-building role within the Arizona delegation as well? You mentioned how he was respected by the Republican members of Congress.
He did. He did. He was a senior member for most big portion of his tenure there, but his willingness to put the partisanship aside paid off in spades for him. That you don't see a lot of that anymore these days, and he was able, and he embraced it, and was able to do it, and was able to serve the state of Arizona. I would submit one of the better congressmen we've had in the last few decades.
Art, this is something that actually Mark and I discussed earlier this week when we were remembering Congressman Pastor. The idea that this is someone who, if he got started today because everything seems so negative in Washington, is this the kind of concept that could work today? Someone who, you know, is a partisan person, no question, absolutely was a Democrat, but still wanted to work both sides of the aisle. Does it seem less possible now, or have we sort of over-dramatized that?
It may be slightly less possible, but I believe it actually can be done today, and I think it's still being done today. I think, frankly, the vast majority of the Congress are folks who really want to make it work. They didn't really spend all that time and money to go back to Washington to fail. The problem is it's always the fact that man bites dog makes news. I think the reality is if you're really going to be there long term or for any length of time at all and be successful, you better figure out how to make more friends than otherwise, because friends come and go, enemies accumulate.
Chris, what do you think about that?
I would agree, and I'll illustrate this by telling a quick story. I was out in California. I have a client who is a senior member of the House Natural Resources Committee. You may or may not know, the incoming chairman is Raul Grijalva. And I said, what do you think about him? Because, you know, Grijalva has a reputation of being a progressive bomb thrower, you know, real hard-edged. And he said, you know, he said, I get along great with him. I get along great. You know, we don't agree on everything, but we find common ground. And when we do find common ground, we work together.
How did he try to bring people onto his side and get people to see things his way? Because, Chris, as you say, you know, people probably didn't agree with him, especially when he was in the minority in Congress. It's a lot harder to get things done then. Did he have a particular strategy or method or technique of trying to convince people that Project X should in Arizona should get funding or Bill Y should get good approved?
I think Art can speak to this just as well. I think a lot of Congressman Pastor's success came from style. Okay, style and temperament. The willingness to treat people on the other side of the aisle with respect. The willingness to try to find common ground with people. You do that, you accumulate seniority as he did, good things happen, and good things did happen.
Art, is that nature or nurture, though, when it comes down to this? Because if someone has, certainly we think we can all learn from this sort of thing, but there may be people in Congress now think, boy, I'd like to approach it the way Pastor did, but it doesn't really come that naturally to me. It's not as comfortable.
I think it's some of both, but frankly, I think it's a lot more nature. I think in many cases, nurture takes away from what nature provided. My sense is that one of Ed's strengths was not just that he could get people to help him, but he understood the value of when he could helping them. And they knew that they could count on him for support and help when they had issues if they could find common ground to work on things.
Guys, let's talk about one of the other big stories of the week, and that is the memo that was released, leaked, however you want to say it, from the McSally campaign, kind of a postmortem as to why she lost. And Chris, I wanted to sort of get your overall reaction first before we sort of dig into some of what it had to say.
Well, look, the memo's coming out for one reason, and that is because by the end of the month or the end of December, we're going to have a new Senate seat for Governor Ducey to appoint. The McSally people want to change the narrative. They want to change the perception from she lost and here's why, you know, because of basically being her fault, to one where, well, look, I'm a great candidate. All these other things just happened and there was nothing I could do. Look, I've written these memos. They are what they are. They are revisionist history, if you will. In this case, she's really, there's a narrative developing that she should not have lost, okay, that she had the resources, she had everything that every other Republican Senate candidate who has successfully won had, and yet her outcome was different. So this memo is basically sending a message to people in Washington and here in Arizona that, hey, I'm a good candidate and you should appoint me.
I'm wondering, when you look at some of the reasons that were laid out, basically it seemed like her campaign was saying she had nothing to do almost with the fact that she lost. But when you look at some of the vote totals and how Kyrsten Sinema really overperformed with independents and with Republicans, I wonder if that kind of hurts the argument that's being made in that memo.
It does a bit. The thing that struck me about the memo was this. A large majority of what she cited as the reason she lost, they weren't a big secret. It's not like they didn't know about these things going in. Every Republican candidate, to cite an example, knows that our general election season is 2 months. She knew she was from Tucson before she ran. And, you know, so I actually ironically thought the memo reflected poorly upon her because these were things she could, you know, either she could not control or she knew about before the election started. And it was incumbent upon her and her campaign to address those issues.
Art, I remember when you were on our show a few months ago, even before the primary, you had been to an event people had wanted to sort of let you meet McSally and see what that was like. Overall, were you disappointed in her performance based on what you saw of her before?
I was disappointed, but I saw the disappointment coming. I actually had occasion to sit and talk with Congresswoman McSally and some of her folks, and I suggested to them this. They gave the opposition far too much time to take the lead and to create an image of what the other candidate was. I think they moved slightly further, probably more than slightly to the right, than I thought they actually had to move in order to win the primary. And given the limited amount of time that's been, as has been mentioned, that you have between the primary and general, catching up is awfully tough to do. I suggest to them that I thought, for a number of reasons, they made their lives a lot harder, a lot more difficult than they had to be.
What does this tell us about party politics? Probably more than we know, but Art, you were someone who was a stalwart of the Democratic Party, not quite as much anymore, but when it comes down to how the candidates are chosen, I know it's been really decades since the party controlled it, but when McSally's kind of the anointed one, and then Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Kelly Ward decide they're going to get in, and we can decide whether Arpaio was in to sort of filter votes away from Ward, whatever, ultimately that made McSally have a primary fight, which ultimately hurt the Republican Party, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, all elections are, as a rule, are primaries and generals. If all you do is simply run the primary as if there's never going to be a general, you've made your life more difficult. I think while you have to win the primary to get to the general, you've got to run the primary in a way that reminds people that you really, in fact, have a larger agenda and that you have a scope of interest larger than just your own particular political party. I think the McSally people did fairly poorly at that, and Ms. Sinema, to her credit, made herself seem as if she was something there for everybody.
Chris, before the break, what are your thoughts on that?
I'd actually agree. Martha ran a decent campaign, but this was a year where she had to run a great campaign, and she got herself into a rut, basically, and she was never able to get herself out of it, and it's probably one of the main reasons she lost.
That's Chris Baker. Also here is Art Hamilton with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the newscap here on KJZZ, which continues after this. Good Friday morning. It's the newscap here on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our panelists today are former legislative leader Art Hamilton and political consultant Chris Baker of Trailhead Strategic Communications.
And Chris, before we move on, I want to ask you one last question about the McSally campaign memo. And you started the conversation on this subject by talking about how the reason that this came out was for the potential appointment that she might be looking for if Senator Kyle steps down at the end of the year. There has been some talk, especially from some Republicans in Washington, asking her. There's a rumored phone call between Governor Ducey and Mitch McConnell, where McConnell supposedly said to the governor she'd be a great senator. How do you think that is shaping up at this moment? Because there's some Democrats, especially or some Republicans here in Arizona, who are saying, no, we don't. This is maybe not the best idea.
I think there's Republicans who are saying this is maybe not the best idea. The tough thing in appointing Martha McSally is that the voters said no to her less than 2 months prior. From a political perspective, you know, she lost a Senate race. So why would we want to put up the only Republican who has lost a Senate race in close to, 30 years? I understand why McConnell says, hey, McSally would be great. She raised a lot of money. And if you are Mitch McConnell or the NRSC, that's of paramount importance. My guess is, though, that Governor Ducey will end up taking a pass.
And Art, a name that has been mentioned as a possible Senate appointment is Kirk Adams, who was the governor's chief of staff, announced this week he was leaving that position. As someone who has so much experience in state government, how significant is it for the Ducey administration going forward, for example, to lose someone like Kirk Adams? And do you think Adams is a long shot or short shot for that Senate appointment?
I'll take it in reverse order. I think he may be a bit of a long shot only because of his proximity to the governor's office, but I don't think it's a bad thing or reflects negatively. He served almost 4 years, if not the entire 4 years. I think he did yeoman work for the governor. And most people at that point, particularly if they have a political interest of their own, and Mr. Adams was Speaker of the House. He's had his own share of glory, if you will, on the field. I think he might want to return to private practice, make a few dollars, and look at his options down the road for running for office again.
So he'll have the itch regardless, you think?
Oh, I think so.
Do you still have the itch?
No, sir. I stayed long enough and scratched long enough. I don't itch anywhere.
Chris, what about Kirk Adams?
Kirk's a great guy. I had lunch with Kirk last year. Very open, very forthright that after the election was over, he was leaving. His reasons, as Art said, he wanted to make some money. In terms of getting appointed to the Senate, I'd say he's probably a medium shot. I don't think he is a lock, and I also don't consider him a long shot. But I also, at the same time, there is a lot at stake here. There is, we meaning Republicans, cannot or do not want to lose that seat in 2020. So I think the primary consideration will be, who can we appoint that gives us the best chance of winning?
How significant is Adams' loss to the Ducey administration? We saw in the Brewer administration the importance of a chief of staff who was able to communicate with staff and communicate with the legislature. Kirk Adams seemed like he did a pretty good job at both of those things. How big of a loss to the governor and his team is Adams stepping down, even if they knew it was coming?
Kirk's a big loss. Kirk was appointed when Governor Ducey was first elected because he had all of this legislative experience. He knew all the players at the legislature. And he did a fantastic job. They're now 4 years in. They have other people who have those relationships. So in that sense, they'll be able to replace him. But in terms of someone who is wise counsel to the governor, who can give it to the governor straight, it's a huge loss.
Art, coming from the legislative perspective, how significant is it to know that when you talk to the chief of staff, A, you have a relationship with them, and B, you know that they are really speaking for the governor and what the governor's planning to do?
Oh, that's critical. I always tell people that when I served, and of course that was ice ages ago, the thing I always enjoyed was talking to the chief of staff when you knew that the chief of staff not only had the governor's ear, but really understood how the governor was thinking and working. Because many of the folks I talked to who had that position, if they were really good at what they did and you spoke to them, you knew you'd spoken to the governor. They would recite to the governor what you'd said, why you said it, and how you felt it, in many cases, better than I could have said it. When you don't have that relationship, you don't really trust it, and you then want to follow up. And the governor really can't afford to have all 90 people, he used to call us the 90 dweebs, downstairs talking to them individually.
Well, I'm always curious, Art, as well, how this works together, because we have now Daniel Scarpinato is going to take over the position, and we know him as a communications guy, worked nationally for Republicans as well. So ultimately, I wonder when a governor makes decisions like this, how he has to balance out how things are going to work, because people know. Obviously, I don't know them personally like Chris probably does, but personalities between Kirk and Daniel are quite different, at least the ones that we see. So is that something that a governor has to think about as well?
Well, absolutely. I think you have to understand that at the end of the day, the person who's going to have that position has to have not only a feel for the people who he or she is going to be dealing with, but you also have to know what their problems are, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and what their propensity to be helpful or hurtful when you need their help.
Chris, in this case, does that matter, or it's the governor's agenda?
It is the governor's agenda, and my guess is you're going to see the legislative agenda being pushed more by his legislative people this time around, and I think Scarpinato will continue to play a huge role in communications.
Is it safe to say, Chris, that having somebody take over that chief of staff position, who's also been with the governor for all 4 years like Adams was, maybe make it a smoother transition than bring someone else from outside?
It's a huge trend. It's huge. It's absolutely vital. You bring in someone from the outside and you're in effect starting all over again. Scarpinato, I think, will do a very good job, but the institutional knowledge, his institutional knowledge of the way the governor's office runs is invaluable.
Not only because it's hard for some of us to let go of the horse race. Chris, we mentioned Kirk Adams, possibly, with the Senate appointment, Martha McSally. Are we going to hear the same names we heard several months ago? Are we going to hear some different names? Is there anyone you would say is closer to a frontrunner?
I actually have no idea who the frontrunner will be. I think you'll hear a lot of the same names. Look, relatively speaking, you know, it's maybe 5-10 people who could credibly, you know, tick off what you need to tick off, which is ability to raise money, ability to run a strong campaign, and some semblance of statewide name ID. You check those three things off and you have maybe 5-6 people.
Now, we still think about how legendary of course John McCain was. People think about Barry Goldwater as well. So this seat, to a lot of people, means more. So it has to be something more than just a political appointment. Do you think that is going to be on the governor's mind when it comes to this? Or is it, to some extent, short-term political gain?
I think it's both. I think you certainly want to think long-term. But I think, Chris, right, you need someone who's probably going to be able to hold that seat in 2020. At the end of the day, no matter how many people want it, no matter how many memos are written, this will come down to a committee of one who will get to decide.
Chris, when you talk about the ability to run a strong campaign, does that to you indicate that the governor might be looking at somebody who has run a campaign before, as opposed to somebody who has maybe been on the policy side of things or appointed to other things, but maybe not run a campaign before?
I'd be surprised if he does not pick someone with campaign experience. And here's why. This is a legacy thing, whether he likes it or not, for Governor Ducey. Whom he appoints will, absent something extraordinary, will be the person who runs the general election in 2020. So he'll either be the person who keeps the seat in Republican hands, or he'll be the person who loses the seat to the Democrats. And my sense is Governor Ducey does not want to appoint the person who loses the seat.
Well, how does the governor try to think about what the political climate might be like in 2 years to figure out which candidate, which appointee slash candidate in 2020 might be best positioned to win in a climate that, I mean, seems to change from hour to hour, if not day to day?
It does change, and that is the biggest concern here right now. My guess is they either have and my understanding, been rejected, tried to persuade Kyle to maybe give them 6 more months so that they can get a better feel for what the environment will be like in 2020. My understanding is that's not going to happen. So he's going to have to basically make an appointment blind. He's going to have to, you know, try to figure out who the best candidate is. And right now, no one in this room, and for that matter, no one really knows what 2020 will be like.
And Art, considering what we knew when we knew it, did John Kyle make sense as an appointment to you?
Absolutely. It was an absolutely, I thought, splendid appointment. John is eminently qualified, incredibly well thought of, has been in the Senate and the House, knows that process, hit the ground running, ready to go. I think it was a superb choice.
The only concern that we've heard is that he really retired because he really wanted to be retired and hasn't really loved the experience when he came back.
Oh, I think everybody knew when he was appointed and agreed to take it, he wouldn't love the experience because he knew what the experience would be like. But he's a soldier. He realized he could do what was best for Arizona. He picked up the mantle and ran with it. I think it was a great choice, and he deserves to get a chance to come home if that's what he wants to do.
And Chris, finally, knowing what we know now, does the Kyle appointment still make sense?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Does the Kyle appointment still make sense, knowing what
we
know
now? It makes huge sense. It took a very difficult situation off the table for Governor Ducey. You basically put in the one person in Arizona who could step in, hit the ground running, and do a good job and be non-controversial.
That's political consultant Chris Baker of Trailhead Strategic Communications. Also here, former legislative leader Art Hamilton. Guys, thanks for being here. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.